Welcome to another edition of the Law of Code podcast.
Anything mentioned in this episode by Jacob Robinson or his guests is not legal advice or investment advice. All opinions are Jacob's and his guests alone. Nothing discussed today should be relied upon for legal or investment decisions. This show is solely for information and entertainment purposes only. Jacob and his guests are not your lawyers, nor are they investment advisors. Please work directly with a lawyer or investment professional.
All right, everyone. Welcome to part two of the Law of Code podcast with the DeFi Education Fund. We have Amanda Tuminelli, the DEF's chief legal officer, and Jake Chervinsky, who is Variant's chief legal officer and a board member at the DEF. And we recorded part one and part two together. This is the second of the two parts. The first spoke on the Roman storm matter, or the Romans matter, which involved Tornado Cash, and that was released last week. Today, and in this episode, we're talking about the pre-enforcement lawsuit against the SEC that the DEF launched together with co-plaintiff Beba, an apparel company based in Texas that challenges the SEC's regulation by enforcement approach to crypto and their policy that free airdrops are securities transactions. And so we'll get into the two claims in the complaint, but I want to start with the facts. Who is Beba and why are they involved in a case like this?
Sure. So Beba is, as you said, a small apparel company that's based in Waco, Texas. It was started by two brothers who were raised in Kenya and saw firsthand how great craftspeople in Kenya are and saw a way to benefit local craftsmen there by using Kenya resources in the United States. And so they have been marketing duffel bags, backpacks, other accessories that are all made from materials from Kenya and by local Kenya craftsmen. So it's just this really lovely, warm-hearted company. And they decided to, they're by no means a crypto company, but they decided to start using digital assets as a way to reach a wider consumer base. So they created these beautiful NFTs that feature Kenya-related artwork. And then they decided to create a Beba token. And that is for a marketing purpose. They did a free airdrop of a portion of the Beba tokens, and they'd like to do a future airdrop with more Beba tokens. The one they've already done was totally free, dropped to unsuspecting users on Base, and they would like to basically repeat that and also drop to additional people as a way to reach more people.
And so how would someone like Beba get involved with the DEF? Where does that connection come about?
It comes about at Consensus. I met one of the founders of Beba early last year, and we both ended up at Consensus, and he was wearing a very cool backpack. And I said, I was in the Blockchain Association's member lounge, and me and the other people I was standing with were like, wow, that's a really cool backpack. Where'd you get that? And he said he made it. So we got to talking about this company that he created with his brother. And over time, we both realized like this was the suit that we wanted to bring. We both felt like the SEC has done a lot of harm to this industry and our interests were aligned. So that's really how it came together.
When you decide to go on offense, what factors go into something like that? So this is a clear example of the SEC hasn't gone after Beba that I'm aware of in any capacity, at least publicly, but Beba is going after the SEC and the DEF is accompanying them. So why now, and what made this the right case to do it?
So I'll start with why now. Why now is because we are not going to see movement from Congress this year, most likely. And the earliest we might see clarity from Congress is next year. That's just how we're viewing it. So DEF, we bring this Administrative Procedures Act claim, which we'll get into. But the basis of that claim is that the SEC has been regulating this industry by enforcement and not by prospective clear rules. So the longer that continues, the more harm is done to industry participants. It's every day you wait, the worse it gets. Of course, we wanted to do this at the first opportunity that we could. So that's why now. The idea is to hopefully put a stop to that pattern of regulation by enforcement. As far as the factors that go into deciding to do impact litigation, and I think Jake should also weigh in here, just generally with impact litigation, what you're trying to do is figure out building blocks to get to the clear rule that you hope to get to in the end. You're not going to get the exact ruling or holding that you want that's going to like regulate the whole industry in this perfect, clear way, but you want building blocks to do that. The way we've been thinking about it in general is what are the base principles we can establish first to get to clear guidance later? And that's how we've thought about what is the right question to ask to a court first.
Yeah, I agree completely with that. I'll give you my own gloss on the questions of when and how we do impact litigation. And of course, impact litigation is not a new concept. It's just somewhat new to the crypto industry, but it's been used by litigants for decades in order to obtain changes to policy through the judiciary, as opposed to getting changes to policy through the legislature or through the executive branch. And like Amanda said, we are in a position now where the executive and the legislature are either neutral on crypto or are hostile toward crypto. And the judiciary is frankly largely untested. So that's why now is the right opportunity for us to take issues to the courts. We also labor under this world where regulators tell us what they think the law is, and we disagree with them in their interpretation of the law, yet they are the ones with regulatory authority and enforcement authority. So we see them going after good actors in the industry and coercing them to take settlements on the threat that there will be an enforcement action that could destroy the company, even if the company wins in litigation in the end. And so that, I think, justifies us bringing those questions of law where we think we have the better view than the regulators to courts sooner than just waiting for the agencies to bring enforcement actions and then hoping that we win those issues in a defensive posture. So that's why we think it's so important to do this now. In terms of how we do it and which questions we bring to the court, like Amanda said, we want to start with questions that we feel very confident we will win. And I think the Beba case represents a couple of really important questions that we'll get into that we feel we absolutely have the right view of the law. We also want to bring cases from a strategic perspective that have asymmetric upside for us. In other words, cases where if we win the case, it will have a significant impact for the entire industry beyond just the litigants in the case. Right? Winning this case means a lot more than just safety and security for Beba or an administrative procedure win for DEF. It means clarity for a broad swath of the industry. And we also want to bring cases where if, in the worst case scenario, a judge does get the issue wrong, and that does happen sometimes, the downside of the judge getting the issue wrong is minimal and won't cause a lot of harm to the industry. And I think we've identified a case here with Beba where there is asymmetric upside in bringing this case.
Yeah, let's talk about that upside quickly, because I think it's an interesting and very important point, right? That the impact of a case like this goes far beyond just one company and one particular case, where especially in the idea of free airdrops, and we've seen that happen time and time again with crypto. We've also seen, and I've seen in a personal capacity, and I'm sure you both have seen as well, where there's a lot of companies that refrain from doing things like airdrops because of this chilling effect, because of those conversations, those settlements that occur without clear rulemaking and discernible steps to launch something like an airdrop. So what is the upside here? What's the best case scenario that when you launch a pre-enforcement suit like this, you're hoping for?
So I think there's two pieces to it. The first centers on airdrops and the second centers on the SEC's rulemaking authority. So maybe I'll start with the airdrop side of the case. And really at its heart, this case is about whether airdrops are investment contracts. And my strongly held view as a matter of both law and policy is that airdrops should not be subject to the federal securities laws. So let me explain why I say that, both as a matter of law and as a matter of policy. And starting with policy, as we all know, the purpose of the securities laws at their core is to address information asymmetry between the issuer of a financial instrument and the purchaser of that instrument. When we talk about the investment contract analysis, the reason that you would treat an investment contract as a security and force an entrepreneur to make disclosures and comply with all the other regulatory obligations of the securities laws is because there's an investor who is trusting that entrepreneur with their capital and therefore is entitled to have information that otherwise only the issuer would have access to. So we apply the securities laws to close that information asymmetry in the context of an investor who is putting capital at risk. And when we talk about airdrops, that simply is not present, right? If you get an airdrop for free, you have put nothing at risk, and therefore there is no justification to apply the securities laws to the creator and distributor of that free asset. And when you look at the law, I think the law very closely reflects that policy in the Howey test's first prong, which requires an investment of money. And for a very long time, we've heard the SEC address the investment of money problem basically by saying, you can have an investment of money, even if there are no investments, and even if no money changes hands. And I think that's just a facially preposterous perspective. My view, and I think the view that the courts will adopt and that we've seen in other cases, such as Judge Torres's opinion in the Ripple case, is that number one, there must be an investment from the investor to the entrepreneur, that is the person who is operating the common enterprise that is the subject of the investment contract. And number two, there actually has to be money, that is definable and tangible consideration that the investor is putting at risk by trusting the entrepreneur. And in the case of an airdrop, the SEC says there is some intangible contribution or promise by the recipient of the token to carry out their own efforts that will contribute to the network effects of the protocol. And that type of activity is an investment of money. And I think that is simply not correct. So going to court to get an order that explains what the investment of money prong actually means is extremely important, particularly because airdrops have become the market standard for how digital assets get distributed in the modern industry. In 2020, we started seeing the beginnings of common airdrops. And the process back then was an initial surprise airdrop where folks would just all of a sudden get tokens that they never expected to get. And airdrops have really evolved since then to the point where now we have very targeted airdrops that incentivize particular user behavior with respect to a particular smart contract protocol or other platform, where the users know exactly what behavior they're supposed to carry out in order to be entitled to the airdrop. We also see founders doing multiple consecutive rounds of airdrops. And this is an excellent and important tool to get engagement and incentivize behavior with respect to these protocols. As long as the users are not actually putting capital at risk in the hands of the entrepreneurs, there's no reason why the securities laws should apply. Nonetheless, because of regulatory uncertainty, we see project after project blocking the United States and refusing to airdrop assets to US persons. So we have the Securities and Exchange Commission protecting investors by protecting them from getting free money. And that doesn't make any sense at all. And I think this case can help clarify that issue.
Yeah, it's a great example of going away from the first principles idea of protecting investors through disclosure and regulating for regulating's sake. It's the idea that if you're holding a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so I think that's a great explanation. So let's go through those two complaints. Let's first talk about the Administrative Procedure Act claim. And Amanda, I was wondering if you could expand on what that claim is and what you and Beba are asking the court to do.
Sure. So in the Administrative Procedures Act claim, we are saying that the SEC has violated the APA because they have created a final rule, even though it may not be written down in a rulemaking, but they have created a final rule and they have done that without submitting it for public notice and comment. And we actually address head on the fact that they have not done a rulemaking because we think that they have purposefully avoided doing a rulemaking so that they can avoid the exact type of review that is necessary here. We think they have finalized a rule that goes something like, there is a presumption that whenever a digital asset is involved in a transaction, the SEC thinks that transaction is a securities transaction and the token itself is a security, giving them jurisdiction and the power to regulate it. So we think that they may take inconsistent positions in different lawsuits. But the through line, if you look at all of their complaints and the cease and desist order since Chair Gensler took office, the underlying premise of all of those actions is that this presumption applies. If in one case they name different tokens, if in another case they say, oh, the tokens themselves are not securities, it's just the way they're offered on this digital asset trading platform, that may be true, but there is clearly this presumption that they are applying to digital asset cases. And it, in our opinion, it must be the case that there is a guiding principle here for all of these enforcement actions. And It doesn't make sense otherwise. So that is a violation of the APA. You purposefully avoid doing a rulemaking so that you avoid notice and comment. That is still a violation of the APA. So that is the legal argument. It's obviously also getting at the theme of them regulating by enforcement. And of course, they're going to say, oh, we haven't finalized a rule. We're just applying the securities laws as they've existed since the 1930s. But we as an industry already know that's just simply not the case. And there has got to be a rule that bridges the gap between laws passed in the 1930s and digital assets in the present time. And that's the rule that we're focused on. That's the rule that they're using to regulate the industry.
And a rule like that will be so interesting to see be built out, because you have this idea of free money, right? A free airdrop. That also does provide value, as you both have alluded to, the founders and the creators of that token, right? They get, whether it's marketing, whether it's potential liquidity, there's just so much that happens on the back end. When they're not necessarily selling their token, though, they're not parting or they're not receiving any investment from those original holders of the token. And even if the fact is that those tokens trade on secondary markets, that still doesn't lead to an investment. But there can be said to be a benefit to them to have those tokens trading on the secondary market. So just curious if you had any thoughts on that. Sort of the best argument that the SEC could have is that there is still a benefit given to the project that does airdrop the tokens.
So though I do not enjoy being put in the position of defending the questionable theories that the SEC puts forward in court cases, I think that they would say they love this little ecosystem point they've been making recently, and they are going to hang their hats on it, in my opinion. It is their best argument. I think it's wrong, but it is their best argument. They say that if there's a token and there is some form of an ecosystem, and the token value rises while work is simultaneously being done in their conception of that in the ecosystem, overall, the token reflects the value of the ecosystem. It carries the ecosystem with it for all time, no matter how many times it trades hands or where it gets traded. And they, I think, use that to satisfy, in their minds, the common enterprise and efforts of others prongs together. And they just loop everybody in. And the problem with that argument, and we've said this in various other amicus briefs, is that makes all collectibles that have any kind of community support securities. There is no, that argument completely applies to Magic the Gathering, where individual Magic trading cards are sold for tens of thousands of dollars on secondary market trading platforms for cards. And there is a whole, there are competitions, right? There's a circuit of people who play Magic, and there is certainly an ecosystem. I don't think anybody would disagree. But if the Magic ecosystem means that Magic trading cards are securities, that's going to be really surprising to a lot of people. It's going to apply to all collectibles. So I think that the SEC's argument, I just think they're way out over their skis, but I think that's what they would say. And that's what they have to do to create liability in the secondary trading market, I think. But I'm interested to hear what Jake says about that.
I totally agree. I think the only argument that they can make is to ignore the distinction between primary sales and secondary transactions. What they will say is there are investments of money because there are purchasers of these assets. It may be that the initial recipient did not make an investment of money, but there will be secondary market purchasers who are risking some capital by purchasing an asset and then looking to this vaguely defined ecosystem for this promise of profit. I do think that is what they will have to argue. I think the problem is that argument runs into a brick wall when you actually look at the law and you look at the Howey test. Now, the SEC is going to say, of course, we should interpret the securities laws very expansively. That's what Howey says. We should ignore form and focus instead on economic reality. Except the Howey test also addresses the investment of money issue directly. It says that the Howey test, the test devised by the court in that case, space was designed to address the various schemes devised by those who seek the use of the money of others on the promise of profit. And I've said this phrase so many times, I have it memorized. So I'll say it one more time. Those who seek the use of the money of others on the promise of profit. And what that means is it is the entrepreneur who is seeking the use of the money of the investor on the promise that the entrepreneur has made to make profit for the investor. The law simply does not apply to secondary market transactions, and the SEC can't twist the law just to fit what it wishes the law said.
And we did see in the Ripple case as well, right there, that distinction was made for secondary transactions compared to the initial distributions and sales.
And not only, that's a great point, but also in the Ripple case, Judge Torres does address this question of what money actually means. And she says it must be tangible and definable consideration. She addresses this in the context of employees working for Ripple Labs who had options, or rather had grants of XRP by virtue of the labor that they contributed to the company. And so Judge Torres analyzes this as a potential investment of money, the labor that an employee gives to its own employer. And she says even that amount of effort is not an investment of money for Howey purposes. So if that's not an investment of money, then there's no way the court could say that this vague, intangible promise that the recipient of the airdrop will participate in the platform and that will enhance the network effect and that will then yield some benefit to the entrepreneur. There's no way that a court says that is an investment of money.
Yeah, and I loved when, Amanda, you were giving the answer for the SEC. You turned around halfway and gave the counterargument. And I think it's such a good example, though, of what their stretching of the securities rules does and all the potential different actors, whether it's sports memorabilia to Magic the Gathering cards. All these actors are now are affected for having these ecosystems that can foster speculation around threats, right? And I think that goes to the heart of a lot of the arguments both of you have put forward throughout the years in crypto. If we are to see the DEF and Beba win this case, what does that look like and what happens after that?
I wish that we would just win in the next few months, but unfortunately, I think it's going to take years. But I think what we would see next in this case is like the SEC will move to dismiss the case. They'll have 60 days to respond and then we'll get discovery, which I think is actually really important. I think it would be very important for this industry to, as we saw in Ripple, even to see internal documents from the SEC that reveals this final rule that we're talking about and shows the way that the SEC is analyzing cases, right? There's something they're doing when they decide whether to file a complaint or whether they decide to launch an investigation. And that could provide more guidance to the industry in the interim. But if we win the whole thing, which we hope to do, I think it would provide a clear example of a way that projects can release tokens into the world, right? If Beba prevails on claim one, they get a court order that says a free airdrop of tokens is not a securities transaction. That is very helpful for other projects in the space to know, okay, so if we do a free airdrop of our tokens, at least one court thinks that we are not engaging in unregistered offering of securities. So I think it can provide real guidance. If we prevail on the APA claim, this the hope here is that this regulation by enforcement pattern stops, because the judge would say to the SEC, you have violated the APA. You cannot continue to enforce this final rule the way that you have been. It will be up to the judge whether they want to go so far as to order the SEC to do rulemaking. That could very well be the outcome, or the judge could just stop and say, you violated the APA, and then it's up to the SEC to make a change in response to that. I also think in the interim, Coinbase's petition for rulemaking, there may be a resolution there. So it may be that the SEC is forced to do rulemaking anyway. But I think what has been really positive in the past few months is it feels to me like there is a groundswell. There is, the industry is aligned. We are all trying to go in the same direction of getting clarity from the judiciary specifically, and leaving room for Congress, of course, to weigh in here. And I think everybody hopes that will happen next year when it's feasible. But I feel like there has been a really positive momentum in the industry recently to be proactive. And that has been really good to see.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And just to zoom out a little bit and put it into context, I think all of what the industry is doing right now on the impact litigation front, on the policy front, lobbying, being involved in the election this year, is an effort to get regulatory clarity. Right? The problem isn't so much that folks don't want to be regulated, right? The industry is absolutely willing to follow the rules. We just don't know what the rules are. And that's what we're trying to figure out. And unfortunately, in trying to figure that out through good faith engagement with the executive branch, we've been met basically with a refusal to cooperate and this regulation by enforcement strategy, where the SEC says, come in and talk to us. And then whatever the industry says to the SEC just so shows up in a Wells notice or in a complaint next. And instead of engaging that way, the goal is to get some clarity from the courts, which itself will help the industry understand what the law is, but also will pressure the agencies and elected officials and Congress to actually clarify what they think the law should be. So if we get a ruling here that says that airdrops are not securities transactions and airdrop tokens are not investment contracts, but Congress believes that digital assets should be subject to some comprehensive regulatory framework nonetheless, such as the one that Representative McHenry has put forward in the FIT Act, it means Congress actually has to do its job and adopt new laws. And if the SEC wants to say, we are going to presume that all digital assets are securities, they need to write that rule down and they need to put it out for public comment and they need to listen to what the industry and others in the public have to say about it. And then they need to be subject to challenge under the APA once they finalize that written rule. And so this is an important step toward getting regulatory clarity in that way.
Yeah, and I think this case is a great illustration of the shifting trend of the crypto industry from almost hiding in obscurity to playing defense to now moving towards the offense. And having been in the space for a few years now and having had this podcast for almost 4 years, it's really interesting to see that development happen over time. And you can start to see the strength of these arguments in cases like the Beba case, as well as the Roman Storm case that we spoke about earlier, in the work that the DEF is doing. So thank you both for all the work that you do. I know how much time things like this can take. And thank you for joining me today. Is there anything else that people should know or that you both, maybe we'll start with you, Amanda, but anything you're in particular keeping an eye on over the next couple months when it comes to either legal cases, regulatory updates, or anything in between?
So there's a lot of active litigation right now that I am following. I think the Legilex and CFAT versus the SEC action, which is also filed in district court in Texas, is going to be really interesting to follow. They filed over a month ago now, so maybe we'll get some kind of response from the SEC in another month. So I'll definitely be paying attention to that. I'm, of course, paying attention to the Coinbase petition for rulemaking and next steps in the SEC versus Coinbase, Kraken, and Binance cases. So there's a lot going on. I will just again say Roman Storm's case is really important, and I hope that everybody is paying attention to what is going on there because it is criminal. Liberty interest is at stake. It is the highest stakes that there is in the judicial system. So I just encourage everybody to really pay attention to what's going on there.
I second everything that Amanda said. I'm watching all of that as well. Instead of listing other interesting things to watch, because we could go on for another entire podcast, I think I'll end with more of a call to action, which is to say, we at DEF and also many others in the industry are just getting started in terms of our impact litigation strategy. And if you want to understand that strategy even more than from listening to this conversation, you can look at the CoinDesk op-ed that Amanda and I wrote a few weeks ago when the Legilex case was filed, which we used to express our view on how impact litigation can be used for the industry. And we are still very actively considering other opportunities to bring cases to the court. And, you know, we've discussed here how we think about impact litigation in terms of finding cases that have asymmetric upside. If you are outside counsel at a law firm looking for an opportunity to get involved in this industry, and you have some creative idea about an impact case that you think we or someone else in the industry should bring, please get in touch with either of us. We would love to talk to you about it.
Thank you, Jake. And thank you, Amanda, as well, for joining me for this great conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.